how did you get into working on soap operas originally?
I got into soap operas because the short story is that I was working for Stephen Bochco on Cop Rock. And I was a PA, and I could make a really great turkey sandwich. And so they liked me, right? And
that's how you get places.
That's really is. The DP liked the fact that I could get the right mustard on the right side of the bread, et cetera, et cetera. So he let me light some scenes, you know, and kind of took a liking to me. And then Stephen Bochco said to me, there's a job for you, because Cop Rock was canceled, and this was November. And he said, there's a job for you on Doogie Howser. Well, Doogie Howser was starting at the end of August. So I had to go December, January, February, March, April, May. I said, well, how do I eat, you know, between now and then? And he said, well, you go over to the Century City Mall and you get a job at the Gap, and then we'll see you in August. And previous to that time, I had been an intern. The Academy of Television Arts and Sciences runs an internship program. And so I had won that, and I was on a soap opera. And they ran 12 months a year. 5 days a week.
You like that?
And I said, oh, that is up my alley. And I get to do what I like to do every day. I don't have to wait 3 years to do it. And I can have a wife and a house and kids and a car. So I thought that soap operas were
paycheck.
Really, yeah, I thought they were really great.
I lived in South America. I lived in Colombia in 1994, 95. And I learned a lot of Spanish from watching the telenovelas, the soap operas in Colombia. But I remember being dumbstruck by how good they were. They had story arcs. They had beginnings, middles, and ends. And they were just this different creature, but they called them essentially soap operas.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder, you know, with beginning sort of with The Sopranos, like I just remember watching The Sopranos and thinking, oh, I remember seeing that kind of thing in Latin America back in the mid-90s. This is a, you know, multi-season soap opera.
Really, nighttime television, episodic television, really ended up borrowing from soap operas and telenovelas. Mm-hmm. They're the ones that sort of co-opted it, and they did it very well. And the point was to find something that was just serialized enough to make you come back next week, right? They couldn't make it too complicated, because then you couldn't remember everything that had happened last Tuesday.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of discussion for nighttime television of, oh, can they remember that much or this much, or dumb it down or make it smarter or whatever it is, in order to create that need of coming back.
Hmm.
And so that's what created, to me, nighttime television, because before it was very episodic, Dragnet, you know, they were all like one episode in, one episode out.
Yeah, exactly.
Correct, right? But then they decided, oh, with Dallas and Knott's Landing, those are soap operas. They took those stories, right, in order to create people coming back, because they wanted repeat customers.
Right.
And that's what's so fabulous about serialized drama.
You're going to be talking tonight at Colorado College about how the television business, how media is changing now that we have just such an explosion of choices in terms of what we watch, when we watch it. You're calling it disruptive innovation. Talk about what you mean by that.
Disruptive innovation is really, it's sort of the new normal of technology. And it has entered our lexicon, and it has taken over huge businesses. And you start talking about big businesses' lack of ability to adapt, you start thinking about the big three automakers and what happened with Toyota. That same disruptive innovation is happening in television. In 2009, the FCC basically turned it into data as opposed to an analog RF technology. And as soon as you did that, as long as the memory was big enough, now you could trade that data over the internet, which then disrupted the way to make television, because now everyone has a distribution channel. And so what's happening is they've taken something where the cost entry point was way too high for the average prosumer, and they've made it available to them again. So in essence, we're at the beginning or a brand new opportunity for everybody to create their own content. And it's about finding the good content,
right,
and how to source that content and then monetize that content. And so to me, it's a very, very exciting time. And that's why I call it disruptive television. It's television 2.0.
So where are we at right now in terms of the big picture of distribution and everything? And where do you think we're going to be in 5 or 10 years in terms of, you know, how people are consuming television and other media, radio, and how do you think people are going to eventually be able to monetize it? Will it ever return to the levels that it was at when we did just have the big three networks?
It will return to the levels in a different way. I'll answer that first. What in my opinion, what's going to happen is if I were going to make a series for diabetics in Colorado College, for example, this area, I can't make much money. But as soon as I'm making a series for diabetics of college age and their experience, now I've opened up the marketplace to the world, right? And so now it's a niche marketing, and you've got to go in, you've got to find your person, and you've got to get your content to them, and it has to be good content. So in essence, we're taking the pie and we're making it really huge, but what you need to do is find a sliver, right? And deliver that sliver good content that then you can monetize to them.
So what does that mean for local media, for the local newspaper, for the local radio station such as KRCC? What if your audience really isn't national, and how do you see that playing into this picture of the future that you see?
You have libraries and libraries of content that can be reused, retooled, repurposed. You need to start looking at that content and looking at it from a transmedia point of view, because you're going to get a smaller revenue stream. So you need 19 different revenue streams. So you need the small 30-second snippet to the half-hour program, right? And all of those things need to keep generating new content. So you kind of use that, right, to go out and create more slivers of revenue, which that gives you enough revenue to create content right now, right? And then that you reuse and repurpose that. So, and you also need to start looking at, in my opinion, live events, as much topical as you can, because that still has a life after the fact, but it drives audiences to you right now for your traditional distribution. Basically, you have to get bigger thinking, right? It's a huge opportunity right now if you break out of the mold, break out of the envelope, and say, okay, this is what I'm going to do. Because you can go after that little sliver. Right now, it's not 100x to your revenue, so CBS isn't interested. They're not your competition, right? They're not going to go after the professor who is up for the Nobel Prize but didn't win it, right? Well, there's a great story there, right? And you can get an audience for that, and you only need a sliver. Right, you need to keep driving all these little slivers to yourself, and that subverts the big guy, and that's how you take them over.